Accession number 29958, Reel 9.
This is the fifth reel of a taped interview with Brian Minchin in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 29th of the 2nd, 2007, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Brian, obviously you were talking about the celebrations that you would have on VE Day.
Sure.
The realisation that war in Europe was now over. Mm. But that didn't necessarily mean that it was over for you.
No, that's quite right. We were very excited, of course, at the news, and the celebrations that we experienced were great. But we also realised that our squadron was being formed into a transport squadron. We were to be known as the 466 RWF, 466 RWF Squadron Transport Command, and we were to, when we had finished at the base in Driffield, we were to travel to Bassingbourne. But prior to this, of course, we had numerous flights out to the ocean carrying many thousands of tons of bombs, which were dropped in the ocean well out to sea at a designated spots. And also, as well as that, we were given the benefit of a low-level flight. I'm not sure whether I mentioned this before, a low-level flight in our aircraft over Germany and Holland, when we went to, firstly, we passed over Antwerp, which was on the coast, and there was one of the large ocean liners that had been sunk in the port there was on its side. I'm afraid I can't remember the name of that particular ship. However, from there we went over Bonn, Cologne, where, as I mentioned before, Cologne Cathedral was intact, and previously I had indicated that I was quite unhappy about the fact that Germany had obliterated one particular cathedral, which I couldn't remember at the time, but it was Coventry Cathedral, and we subsequently visited that after the war, and it had been totally destroyed.
People do talk of you know, returning to places like London and comparing those places that had been bombed to places in Europe that had really received total concentration,
sure,
and literally comparing them to rubble.
That's right.
In a place
right.
like Dresden, you were literally, you know, driving around on tractor tracks in the
well,
rubble,
this is right.
as opposed to in London.
Well, this is exactly the thing that we saw when we flew over. I was about to say we flew over Dusseldorf, and Essen, and Dortmund, and also Munster. Now, Munster, if they hadn't told us that the town below us was Munster, I wouldn't have believed it, because the place was completely obliterated. You could see that there were roads in the city, but all the buildings were completely demolished. And I imagine that all that would happen after the war would be that a bulldozer would move in and completely remove the rubble and rebuild the city again. And last of all, we flew over Amsterdam on our way back. But this was, as you said earlier, most of these cities, especially and some of the smaller towns which were key rail junctions and prime targets, they were completely obliterated. There was very, very little in the way of any building surviving. But the thing that I thought was so great was the fact that in Cologne, this old cathedral had been spared completely, apart from some slight damage to the exterior of the building.
In relation to seeing the destruction. How did it then sort of strike you? How did it strike home in relation to, this is the sort of destruction that you may not have necessarily been causing yourself, but the bomber command had been causing.
Yes, sure.
What did that mean to you?
Well, I know that Munster was one of my targets, and I must confess that it did concern me to think that maybe I'd been responsible for the death of some civilians, but hopefully they were in air raid shelters, and or the population may have been decimated prior to our particular raid. But I must confess that it did concern me a little, but then it was, war is war, and unfortunately when you play with fire you get fire, and the same as we received lots of air raids, and as I think I mentioned before, when you return to base after an operation, there were a number of over the period of the war, I'd imagine there would be dozens or hundreds of aircraft that were shot down by enemy fighters over there, even that followed them back to base and shot them down over their own country. So therefore I don't think that one could accept a great deal of responsibility, as no doubt it's been said by many people who were actively flying aircraft over Germany in the war, that they they were following instructions. And I mean, if you don't follow instructions in those days, you were regarded as a traitor. So you had to do your duty, and that was our duty to do as we were instructed.
I often ask people in this situation, you know, how did you sort of philosophize over your job? How did you live with the consequences of your following orders?
Well. My thinking on that one is that there were many airmen and pilots and crews who undertook some 20, some 40, some 60 operations over Germany, and they would have caused much more destruction, I would think, than I did in the limited number of operations that I carried out, and therefore the level of guilt, if one should accept guilt, was much smaller than those who had gone before me, and many of whom did not survive in any case and paid the supreme sacrifice. So
I was going to ask, did you know of anyone that the guilt was too much for?
No, I must confess I don't know of anybody who may have committed suicide, or maybe who became mentally unbalanced as a result of their operations. But being limited in my experience, it goes without saying that I must confess, in London, when we went to into London to Australia House and the Boomerang Club, I saw quite a number of Australians who were completely, looked like monsters. They had been burnt in their aircraft, and their faces were just raw red skin, just two holes for the eyes, two holes for the nose, no nose structure. And so when you think about this happened as a result of German action, then it's the guilt smartly fades away. But
okay. Well, obviously you're mentioning the duties that you were involved with post VE Day.
Yes.
You, as I understand, would be expecting to take part in the Pacific War.
That's right. Well, as I said, we travelled subsequently to down to Bassingbourne, which is in Hertfordshire, with the squadron, and the aircraft stayed back at Driffield, and we had to convert to Mark 8 Liberators, which is a four-engined American bomber, which had been used by the Americans. Now, the Americans had a magnificent base at Bassingbourne, an officer's mess. In fact, when we walked in, all we could see down the passages entering the mess, the officer's mess, were great long pictures of, should I say it, nude women on both sides of the wall. And this seemed to be typical of what the Americans enjoyed seeing on the walls of their messes. I must confess, we didn't have such drawings or paintings on our walls and our messes in the RAF or RAAF, but this was the thing that first struck me about Americans, American airmen. They liked their lewd paintings and photographs.
Well, you've got to remember that these are young blokes, all fired up with other things necessarily than being at war.
That's right.
And having to do without the sort of luxuries of home, possibly.
That's quite true. I'm only being facetious in saying what I've said, but naturally, all young, red-blooded young men are virtually the same. Maybe they. Their expressions are more conservative of the actual Australians and Englishmen, and far more conservative, I think, than the American servicemen were. However, we were this squadron, transport squadron, was formed with the prospect of moving to the Far East to in the fight against Japan, and so. We converted to these Liberator aircraft. Now, I must confess that these aircraft had been used on a fairly substantial number of daytime operations, and they were completely what I would term, it's not a very nice word, clapped out. That you'd be battling to get them off the ground by the end of the runway. Maybe it was because of the servicing wasn't as good as it could have been, but the engines didn't seem to be as powerful as the engines that in the British aircraft that we flew in the Halifaxes. But we weren't very happy about that, because if we were to travel in these aircraft to the Far East, we'd be a bit doubtful of whether we'd make it there or not, by virtue of the fact that these aircraft were had been overused and weren't in good serviceable order. However, fortunately, the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima and elsewhere, which very rapidly brought the war. War on Japan, war against Japan, to an end, and of course this was also a great cause for another celebration in the mess, and I must say that most airmen were very, very thrilled that they didn't have to go to the Far East to fight a war over there.
Presumably the prospect of fighting the Japanese wasn't exactly a picnic to look forward to.
It certainly wouldn't be, but knowing what had happened in around Papua and New Guinea and in lots of other areas in the Pacific Ocean, with all the naval battles and the record of the Japanese on a number of islands, even down through the Philippines, down to almost to Australia, it wasn't a prospect that one looked forward to. And we were very thrilled to be able to celebrate the final end of the complete war.
Well, you mentioned, obviously, VJ or VP Day.
VP, yeah.
What do you remember of hearing of these atomic bombs and how that side of the war had been?
Yes, well, it was I suppose it didn't really matter to us much what really finished the war against Japan, but obviously we only got to learn about the atomic bomb from the newsreels and from seeing it on the in newsreels, but the main thing was that it caused the Japanese government to give in very rapidly, because of the number of people that were the hundreds of thousands of people that were killed in these from these terrible things. I must confess that I'm not very happy about the use of these weapons, but bearing in mind that it could have saved millions of lives in the long run if this war had gone on for any great length of time, so that in effect it was very pleasing that even though it was a terrible thing to happen to the Japanese people in that area, around Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
People talk. I mean, here you are, a pilot of a bomber.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the biggest bombs that you'd ever drop were sort of spit in the ocean in relation to the description that these.
Bombs. Even though they were only a small bomb, they had such a powerful a destruction factor that you couldn't compare them. And I don't think even the 8,000-pound cookie bombs that were dropped by the Lancasters, the biggest ones that we could drop were 4,000-pounders. So, and they were fairly destructive, but by comparison, the atomic bomb, I would say, would be maybe 1,000 times as destructive as a 4,000 pound bomb. Well, following the end of the war in Japan, we did some trips down to London and experienced there the sight of London lit up for the first time after the European War. Of course, the lights came on after the European War, and we found that all vehicles, the hooded headlights of vehicles the hoods had been removed from the headlights of vehicles, and that things had assumed an entirely different view. We also noticed that in lots of areas, especially around St Paul's Cathedral and down in the towards the business end of London, where there was a lot of demolition, wildflowers were growing in the bombed areas, and yet when you had a look at St Paul's Cathedral and some of the other substantial buildings in the area that were not really damaged, it was hard to believe that strips of land, maybe strips areas, maybe a quarter of a mile by a half a mile long, were completely destroyed, and there were wildflowers growing in these areas. It was hard to visualise that the war really had such an effect on the people of London.
We see this sort of new life, the city again at civilian standing as opposed
that's
to
right.
war footing.
Well, I was able to acquire a number of photographs of London at the end of the war in Europe when it was lit up, where it showed that Buckingham Palace, even though it was undamaged internally, it bore quite a lot of damage on the exterior of the building, and this was shown up in the photographs. But the whole place was floodlit, really, for all the local people and the visitors and overseas service people to take photographs of these buildings for representing the new life after the war in Europe. And it was really, the photographs are excellent, and I still treasure them. I still got them in my album.
Maybe we can send a couple of copies to the Imperial Museum.
Yes, I think that could be quite possible. I'll have a look and let you have those, John. Now, it wasn't long before, I think it was about at the end of November, so that we really had to fill in from the end of August to the end of November before we actually got organised to be repatriated, and we all travelled to Southampton, where we boarded the SS Orion, which a P&O Orient Line ship that was used to carry troops, and it was normally a tourist ship prior to the war, but we boarded the Orion, and and eventually sailed to the Bay of Biscay, but unfortunately, obviously from the volume of work that it had been used for during the war, the engines broke down, and or partly broke down, and we had to return to Southampton, and so in the Bay of Biscay, which of course was not a very pleasant place when it's angry, but we returned to Southampton, and in mid-December we boarded the MV Athlone Castle, which was a South African cruise liner, and we sailed for Fremantle via the Suez Canal, and we arrived back in Fremantle on the 7th of January 1946, and after some short period of leave, a few weeks leave, I was demobilised. Luckily, I wasn't demolished, but I was demobilised on the 20th of February 1946, after three very eventful years of my life.
Well, what was it like to be coming back on a ship post-war experience?
Well,
a whole bunch of young blokes.
Yes. Well,
getting ready to see their loved ones again.
That's right. Well, we weren't very happy, of course, about the Orion breaking down. But when we were on the Athlone Castle, at least the Orion we had bunks. But on the Athlone Castle, even though I was an officer, a flying officer, I spent the whole trip in a hammock, which of course didn't worry us very much because we were going home. I think the thought of going home, I think they realised that there wouldn't be many complaints as long as they fed us and looked after us reasonably well. That there wouldn't be too many complaints about sleeping in a hammock, and at least it was on one of the higher decks, which was we didn't have any internal air conditioning. We had some external air conditioning, which made the trip quite comfortable. But it was going through the Suez Canal. We went through the Mediterranean and then through the Suez Canal. We came across the bum boats at Suez. Where they were, of course, begging for money or whatever we would give them. And then subsequently we travelled through the canal at a fairly slow speed and then on to India. And we had a day off at Bombay where I was sold a very great bargain, so I was told, a beautiful gold gold with a I can't think of the, it was a ruby, that's right, it was supposed to be a genuine ruby and a gold ring, which I paid some maybe 100 rupees for. But when I found that after wearing the ring on the way home from Bombay to Fremantle, that the ring developed verdigris, and my finger was quite green, so that obviously it was obviously a very cheap ring, and I'd of course most probably paid 20 times too much for it. However, that's one of the things that you do. But before we left England, that was interesting. The Air Force gave us the opportunity to purchase some watches, Longines. Some of the well-known watches, which I still have, I'm in still possession of my watch, and it still goes, although it's old-fashioned. I still have it in my drawer, even though it works, because it's too old-fashioned to wear these days. But I think we had to pay something like £5, I think it was £3 that we paid for it, naturally duty-free, on the ship when we way home. So that was another little interesting side piece.
What was life on board like?
Fairly boring. It obviously it took us when we, I think we arrived on the 7th of January, so that we left, I think it was in at the end of November, so it really took us about five or six weeks to get there. And what you'd do would be to sunbake on the upper decks, eat, at meal times, and sleep in your hammock and play cards. It wasn't a very exciting trip, but I think the at the end, knowing that you're going to be home and be reunited with your family, was the thing that kept you sane and happy on board. But there wasn't a great deal of organised activity because the ship was fairly full with Australian servicemen on the way home. But we were, of course, thrilled to be home and see coming into the port of Fremantle, and to see our family waiting for us on the on board down on the wharf, on the Fremantle wharves, and to be reunited was really something. And of course, it's a day one will never forget while one's still alive.
I was going to ask what it was like to sort of see the horizon of your hometown.
Oh yes, well,
your hometown or horizon.
Well, we with Rottnest. Passing Rottnest and coming into the harbour and seeing this great red dingo on the flour mill face of the flour mill in Cottesloe was really something to see.
We should mention to anyone who doesn't know about the flour mill, it's an old symbol on the coast. Yes. This old flour mill with a red dingo. Yeah.
Yes, it was really a large storage bin for the grain, priority being manufactured into flour. But it could be seen for miles out to sea, and this red dingo was just one of those things that was, I believe, it was supposed to be subsequently painted by our friend Alan Bond, who was very infamous in the business world in Western Australia. However,
here you are at home. What was it like to suddenly sort of be back after this big adventure?
Well, it was very exciting, and to see all one's family, my brothers. My brothers returned. I had two younger brothers who virtually grew up, virtually from 3 to 8, they were about 3 to about 6 or 7 years of age when I got home. To see them and to see all our family, and my other brother Ron didn't arrive home until afterwards, because he stayed in England with his wife, and they had a son born in England, and so they didn't arrive home till later. And it was quite surprising when he arrived home not long after us. We went down to the wharf to meet him, and it was surprising the English accent that he had compared with the average Australian. He had a very, very cultivated accent, and having been, I think, having married virtually an English girl, I think it must have influenced him, and also the influence. He was in England longer than I was, and possibly that influenced him. But I didn't ever remember him as having this English accent before he left.
We've got Ron Minchin's story on tape. It's interesting to have his brother telling
a few tales. Yeah, that's right. And but it was great to have him home. And of course, naturally, he couldn't live. He had to find a separate accommodation, whereas we. My younger brother, who was in the Navy, and myself, we returned to live at home, and I resumed after a few weeks of leave and following discharge. I resumed my career with the National Bank, where I started in 1940, and so. From there on, it was just I was concentrating on my career, and I wasn't really very interested in much else in my future career.